Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Healthcare Excise Tax conference call. Currently, all lines are in a listen-only mode. During the conference, we will have an opportunity to ask questions and answers. Those instructions will be given at that time. If you should require assistance from an operator, you may press star then zero, and you will be assisted offline. And as a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Larry Michel, President of the Economic Policy Institute. Please go ahead, sir.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for participating. I'm going to moderate this press conference call. The first speaker we'll have will be Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, now professor at the University of California, Berkeley, followed by Representative Joe Courtney, who will talk a little bit about the politics of the issue. Then I'm going to get on as a speaker to talk about the relationship between healthcare costs and wages, followed by Josh Bivens, a macroeconomist at EPI and an expert on this, who's going to talk a bit about the excise tax and how it raises revenue and its effect on benefits and out-of-pocket spending and things like that. So without further ado, we'll turn it over to Bob Reich.
Thank you, Larry, and thanks to the Economic Policy Institute for arranging this. Just logistically, I'm going to have to leave at 11:30, so I wanted to make sure everybody understood that. The choice here is very clear. Congress should put the cost of health care reform on the wealthiest Americans, who are still doing better than ever, rather than on working families who are struggling harder than ever. The notion that there are somehow Cadillac plans out there, a notion that's basic to the Senate bill, is a misnomer. The Senate's excise tax would fall on many families whose plans are expensive because family members are older or sicker than average, or because they get their health insurance from small businesses that pay more. Smaller firms pay premiums 18% higher on average than large firms for equivalent coverage, and that's because small firms have less bargaining leverage. It's the same with people who are older and sicker. They also pay more. They don't enjoy Cadillac plans. The Senate bill falsely assumes that high cost plans generate high value for beneficiaries. That is not borne out by the evidence. The House surtax on wealthy Americans is not only more progressive and fairer than the Senate's excise tax on high-cost plans, it would also generate more revenues. That is, the House plan would generate more revenues. And finally, in my view, there's a real danger in the Senate plan that many working families needing health care will be forced to cut back on the health care they need, defeating the entire purpose of health care reform if the excise tax is imposed on their plans. They're not going to make up for those increased costs by increases in wages, as some of the analysts working for the Senate have supposed. There's no reason to assume that those wage increases will come forth, particularly in an environment such as we are in now. But even if and when they did, there's no reason to suppose that they would equal the amount of coverage that is foregone, simply because the coverage foregone comes or had come with a tax advantage. And that is not the case with the with wages. So for all these reasons, and we'll get into more and more detail, the House surtax on the wealthy is a far superior way of funding health care than the Senate excise tax on high-cost plans of working Americans.
Oh, thank you very much, Bob. Okay, Representative Courtney?
Thank you, Larry, and thank you, Professor Reich, for your great work and helping make the public case on this issue, which I do think is probably the number one challenge of the conference process that we're in right now. I want to just reiterate a couple points that Professor made. The Joint Committee on Taxation, looking at the tax incidence, which will occur with the Senate plan, determined that 27% of family plans will be hit by the tax in the fifth year of its existence, 22% of individual plans, and that number will just continue to grow because of the inadequate COLA adjustment, the CPI plus one, which was in the Senate bill. The Senate bill will, in fact, impact people older than younger. That actually is codified in the Senate bill. It provides for a 3-to-1 age rating in the Senate language, so the pricing of premiums will definitely vary widely depending on how old you are. That's obviously the case today, and it will continue with health care reform even under the House version. So there's no question that tax incidents will occur higher on people because of how old they are, which has nothing to do with health care utilization. And lastly, the other point is that we know that regional costs also drive premium prices. And those are factors that middle-class families really can't control in terms of, you know, the higher costs of medical practice, hospital overhead, and just regional variation in terms of utilization, which the Dartmouth study has shown. And that drives premium prices. So, you know, for people to be taxed because of these types of factors, which they have no control over, really has no bearing on good health care policy. What I just wanted to chime in terms of the status in the House. This issue percolated up in September and October. I wrote a letter which gathered 189 co-signatures, latest count, to Speaker Pelosi opposing the excise tax. We were able to hold the line and pass the measure, which Professor Reich just described. I believe very strongly that the American people are on the side of the House. The Rasmussen poll that came out a couple days ago shows 66% opposition to the excise tax. That reiterates polling that was done by Washington Post, ABC, USA Today, AP, all showing 2-to-1 opposition to the tax. And in fact, the House approach has strong majority support, again, in all of those polls that I just listed. So both on policy grounds and on political grounds, I think the House approach is the right approach, and certainly those of us who advocated this position during the lead up to November 7th when the House passed its measure are going to continue to advocate this position. And EPI's brief today, I think, really gives us more ammunition with our arguments. I really salute Larry. In the notice for the press conference for the benefit of the press, there's also a compendium of other studies that have come out recently that have added, I think, weight to this argument, including the recent article on Health Affairs, which explored the issue of premium pricing and what real factors drive it as opposed to plan design. So thank you very much, Larry, and look forward to any questions.
Thanks. Okay, now I'm going to just spend a minute or two talking about one claim that's been made, that a benefit of doing the excise tax is shifting the mix of compensation from health benefits to higher wages, and that doing so would actually lead to almost like it's a solution of the wage stagnation that's affected workers for 30 years. The claim has been made that the moderating of health care costs in the late 1990s was responsible for the acceleration of wage growth that happened at that time. And that the fact that healthcare premiums grew more strongly in the 2000s was why there was really poor performance of wage growth in the last decade. So I've looked at the facts of this in a new paper we just released today, and that's on our website and be available to everybody. This is not to deny that if you lower healthcare costs, you could see somewhat higher wages, but in no way can you expect that this is going to lead to great wage growth, because healthcare costs are not that big a part of the compensation package. In 2007, healthcare costs were just 7.6% of the total compensation package, according to BLS. Healthcare costs did become more important part of compensation over the last 20 years, but had they not grown more important, wages would have grown at most 0.1% more a year. That's not really all that much. And in fact, if you look at what happened in the mid-1990s, wages did grow a lot better, and that was a great thing. But the fact is that it grew a lot better because total compensation grew a lot more, not because the mix of compensation between wages and healthcare grew better. Compensation grew a lot faster in the mid-1990s. In the 2000s, when healthcare costs did grow faster, compensation growth was still growing faster than it did in the 1980s and early 1990s. The problem we have is that workers are not benefiting from productivity growth, hardly at all in the last 10 years. And that's because employers have the upper hand. And that's one reason why you wouldn't expect when healthcare costs go down, if they go down as a result of healthcare reform, and I certainly hope that will happen, it's not necessarily that employers are going to raise wages in response. And last, if you look at who's benefited from the higher wage growth of the late 1990s, the people who benefited the most from the higher wage growth were the low and middle wage workers. And those were the workers who have the lowest coverage from health care. The workers with the most coverage from health care at the upper end were the ones who benefited the least from the higher wage. Fine, as far as I'm concerned, but it does suggest that lower health care costs was not the factor driving the better wage growth. And with that, I'll stop there and look forward to questions on this. Turn it over to Josh Bivens from EPI.
Thank you. I'll try to be pretty quick on this. most of the points I'm going to make are actually sort of reiterating points made in a piece by a colleague, Elise Gould, and I, that we released a couple weeks ago. You can find on our website. It's called The House Bill is Right on the Money. It's a issue brief about why the House financing mechanism is better than the excise tax. For one, people have already talked about this, that this is not a tax that is well targeted at Cadillac health plans. And just to provide one statistic on that, less than 4% of the variation in health insurance premiums is actually driven by the generosity of the plan. The overwhelming determinants of a plan's cost are region, age of the workforce, size of small business. This is, in fact, much better targeted at small businesses than lavish plans. And so instead of a Cadillac plan, it would actually be more accurately titled sort of a small business health insurance tax. Two, in order to avoid paying the excise tax, you will see employers offering less comprehensive coverage to their workers, and that's going to be a benefit cut and a shift of health costs and onto workers. So even if they do see some increase in wages because they're getting less comprehensive health benefits, that will only serve to give them the money they need to pay the higher out-of-pocket costs that they're going to face. Some workers, because those out-of-pocket costs are not distributed uniformly, some people are going to have much higher out-of-pocket costs because of the less comprehensive coverage than any plausible wage gains they could have had. So you're going to see a lot of people just outright worse off because of this shift in health risks and health costs. And then lastly, I just want to talk about one point. I mean, supporters of the excise tax act as if it's going to have very beneficial impacts in slowing the rate of healthcare cost growth in the U.S. economy. Any cost containment that the excise tax will actually spur is going to be driven entirely by consumers cutting back on the healthcare they decide to consume. It's not going to be lower prices. It's not going to be more efficiently delivered healthcare. So, for example, if my plan is not hit by the excise tax, I will see no benefit at all from this in terms of a more efficient health sector. It is only the people who are going to be financially driven into consuming less healthcare that are going to be affecting overall healthcare cost growth. And this is not the way to go after the trend in fast healthcare spending in the country. Essentially, you know, you've got experts who say a lot of the healthcare we consume is inefficient. Maybe we should try to squeeze some of that out. I think that's true. This is the wrong way to do it. Consumers are not the people to decide what is the most efficient healthcare to squeeze out, and this is really sort of a blunt instrument for trying to weed out that kind of healthcare that is perhaps inefficient in what's being consumed. And so I think I'll leave it there and give people time for questions.
Okay, so Mr. AT&T operator, it's up to you now on the questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question today, we ask that you press star and then one. If you are using a speakerphone, we suggest that you pick up the handset before asking your questions. And again, if you have a question, you may press star one at this time. Our first question is from the line of Jay Heflin with BNA. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. This is for the Congressman. I've spoken to staffers on the Ways and Means Committee, and they're trying to make their tax look more like the taxes in the Senate bill. If the Cadillac plan is so unpopular, why is Ways and Means working to make it look like the Senate bill?
Well, I think, you know, there's clearly a lot of ideas that are being discussed out there. So far, the House had one phone-in caucus before the Christmas break. The majority of input that came from members at that caucus was objecting to the Senate excise tax. We have, as you know, probably another phone-in caucus tomorrow.
Right.
You know, there's no question that there's other ideas that are being looked at right now. But and the Senate is leaning hard in terms of trying to advocate for their position, and they do have some support, obviously, within the White House. But I think if you listen to Speaker Pelosi's comments last night, frankly, unlike other parts of the bill, this is the one where I think there is still the most resistance because she knows where her caucus is.
So do you think that they won't get 218 if the surtax is not in the final bill?
You know, I'm not going to jump to an endgame scenario right now here. I mean, this is so early still in the process, but I know that 190 signatures and you know, some of the chief of staff meeting that took place over the last couple of days shows that some of the members, the feeling has intensified because of their visit, their time home and talking to their constituents. Some of them are doing polling in their own districts, and they know how toxic this idea is politically. So I think it is way premature to assume, one chamber versus the other prevailing on this point.
Thank you.
Our next question will come from the line of Alec McGillis with The Washington Post.
Oh, hi. Thanks for doing the call. I just wanted to ask the congressman or maybe some of the others about some of the efforts to sort of improve the targeting of the tax in the Senate bill by adding in some kind of regional variation stuff and variation by professions and whatnot, and whether that improves it at all or allays any of these concerns, and if you see any other language out there that's maybe out in the policy world or elsewhere to further improve this so that it might target more at the truly lavish plans.
Well, this is Larry Michel. Let me just say that the fact that the Senate bill does try to carve out some occupations, in fact, is really a recognition that plans which cost a lot are not necessarily plans with lavish benefits. And I think that it's really not possible to target this in that way. If you talk to people who represent teachers, they say that 75% of the plans that teachers have will be covered by this benefit, primarily because they are, you know, older women in there. You know, I think you can't fix the you can't use a tax like this to tax plans that have very, very good benefits by just focusing on how much the plans cost. And that's what research basically shows, that it's not the high benefits that lead are the major drivers of why plans cost a lot. It has a lot to do with the industry, the occupation, the size of firm, and the age, you know, the demographics. So I think it's unfixable in that way, Alan.
Okay.
The only thing I'd just chime in, as far as the regional variation that's in the Senate bill, which allows for a three-year transition period for 17 states, I mean, I query why 17, why not 18 or 16? The fact that it phases out after 3 years, again, just is just totally inadequate in terms of recognizing that, that regional disparity is built in a way that is not going to just get taxed away over a three-year period, and it's just falls far short of what's needed.
If I could just follow up quickly on a related point, one of the arguments for the tax, of course, is that it would make things more fair in chipping away at the tax-free nature of employer-provided benefits. Would you guys counter that by arguing, go so far as to counter that by arguing that some of that unfairness of the way that our benefits are taxed these days is going to be rectified because people buying insurance on their own are now going to be getting subsidies in the exchanges and subsidies that people with employer benefits aren't going to be getting toward their health insurance? Does that in some ways take care of the tax imbalance?
I don't know. This is Larry.
I haven't heard anyone make that argument for, you know, against the excise tax, basically saying, hey, we don't have to worry anymore about the unfairness and the tax treatment because people buying on their own are now going to be getting a lot of help, you know, and subsidies that other people won't be getting.
I think what's very odd is that the whole approach of this healthcare reform, and I support that, is that we're trying to build around the employer-based system. Mm-hmm. And then to actually try to do taxation as a way to try to weaken the employer-based system, I think is a very odd approach.
Okay.
I think what we're saying, Alex, is that it's a the Senate excise tax is a very blunt instrument. Even with efforts made to be slightly more sensitive to the problems that we're raising. It's still going to be an excise tax on older workers and people working for small businesses. And when compared with the house tax on people earning over $500,000 a year, there's no comparison in terms of progressivity, fairness, and targeting.
Thanks.
This is Josh from EPI. Let me just add one quick thing, too. I mean, I think you're right that some of the unfairness in the tax treatment of health insurance is rectified by the broader reform. And also, if people bring up the fact that this could plausibly be a progressive tax change to tax some of these high-cost plans, I mean, if you're worried about the progressivity of overall taxes, there are a million more straightforward ways to deal with it than this. And I would point you to the analysis by Bob McIntyre, the Citizens for Tax Justice. I mean, he points out that actually the implicit subsidy to employer-provided health insurance, it's not as regressive as people think. I mean, when you convert a portion of tax-free health insurance to taxable wages, you're not just getting higher income taxes, but you're also getting higher payroll taxes. And payroll taxes are pretty broadly based, and so it's generally not as regressive an implicit subsidy as people tend to think it is. And so, again, if you're worried about progressivity of overall taxes, there are much more straightforward ways to go after it than this excise tax.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to have to leave in just a minute. Let me just say that a point that we may not have emphasized strongly enough is that the Senate bill is not a good way to control health care costs for all the reasons that we've discussed. And to call it a tax on Cadillac plans seriously distorts the effects and consequences of the tax. You know, if there are many other ways to control costs. I mean, probably the most direct and obvious way, unfortunately not contained in either bill, would allow HHS to bargain with pharmaceutical companies over the prices paid by the Medicare Part D program. You know, there are other ways of controlling costs, but to put the onus on so many older workers and workers, people who are working for small businesses, is not only unfair, but it's also inefficient.
Operator, maybe we should just see if there's any particular questions for Bob before he has to get off, if he can take one more question.
Thank you. If you do have a question specifically for Dr. Reich, you please press star 1 at this time. I believe we have one from Matt Loughman with ABC News. Please go ahead.
Hi, it's actually Teddy Davis here at ABC. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. A question for you. What do you think might be the political implications in November if the Democrats don't get rid of this so-called Cadillac tax? Do you fear that it might open up the Democrats to additional losses in the Congress if it's not fixed? What's your political take on that?
The Democrats are not going to suffer losses simply because of, you know, they choose the Senate plan over the House plan. I do think, though, that Democrats need to be sensitive to the fact that the disparities between wealthy Americans and average working people are growing, and to choose the Senate plan over the House plan would and could simply be another indication of lack of sensitivity to this growing gap. At a time in our nation's history when the top 1% of Americans are taking home 23% of total national income every year, it makes far more sense on policy grounds and on political grounds to tax the top 1% rather than sweep in so many people who are paying more for health care, but not because they're getting more health care, but because they're older or are working for small businesses. Anyway, sorry I have to leave, but hope this is helpful.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank
bye.
You.
We'll take our next question then. It comes from the line of Stephen Greenhouse with the New York Times.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to pose a similar question to the congressman. Now, what do you think will be the political fallout for Democrats if the excise tax is enacted? And, you know, the White House has a lot of smart political people over there. What do they tell you about why they're pushing this, and are they worried about the political fallout?
Well, I'm a little less sanguine than Dr. Reich is about the political fallout. I think that this is an issue which really is, in my opinion, not gotten enough public vetting and airing. It really gathered steam after the August recess with the town hall meetings. I mean, the excise tax was really not even part of the dialogue at that point. And as I mentioned in my opening remarks regarding polling, this is a pretty challenging area for candidates to go out there and defend. I mean, there have been some private polls, I know, among some members, which has really raised eyebrows in terms of the impact it could have. And even though the real genesis of this idea was the McCain campaign who proposed changing the tax status of health plans, the fact of the matter is I don't think the Republicans are going to give Democrats a free pass on this if it is incorporated into the health care bill. And you have to look no further than the Chamber of Commerce ads that have been running incessantly through the fall and winter attacking health care reform. The one tax that their ads target in their messaging is a tax on benefits. And I think opponents of reform understand that, and as well as proponents of reform. And I would just end by saying that, you know, if you go back to the fall of 2008, when McCain proposed this in his platform, the Obama campaign was not bashful at all about going for his throat on that issue. The paid media that the Obama campaign put into this issue of taxing health benefits was huge. And, you know, my office can supply you with some of the scripts from some of the ads about how John McCain for the first time ever will tax health benefits. I mean, the issue had tremendous potency on the campaign trail in 2008. And frankly, I don't see any indication that the change of heart that's occurred amongst the policy people in the White House has really changed the American people's hostility to this idea. So I think it's a plan that has great political risk for the Democrats.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Julian McKay with Inside Health.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Wanted to follow up and see if we could get any more detail on a question that was asked by Mr. McGillis earlier, which is on ways, and there's a lot of discussion right now apparently on ways to change the tax so that it really focuses on the value of the premium plans versus their cost, and actual value in particular may be a way to target plans that are really more generous, not just more costly, because people are older or live in a high-cost area of the country. And wanted to talk to see if the congressman has any reaction to that. If you see any way that you could support a tax that's rewritten to focus on value versus cost.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, as I said earlier, I really feel like it's very premature in the conference process to start talking about endgame. And you know, there's some obvious flaws in the Senate bill, which even its proponents have identified. Bob Greenstein at the Center for Budget and Policy acknowledged that the adjustment for over 55 retirees that leaves out over 55 workers is ridiculous. I mean, the notion that one cohort of over 55 Americans will be have an adjustment on the tax threshold as opposed to another, just falls way short of the attempt to recognize the age impact of premium prices. Similarly, you know, Greenstein pointed out what I mentioned earlier, that the three-year transition period for high-cost states is just, you know, it's, I don't know what they were thinking about over at the Senate Finance Committee, but that just is a joke, that somehow there's going to be equalization of regional costs in 3 years' time. I mean, you just can't legislate that type of outcome. So, you know, those are the, in my opinion, the obvious areas that even proponents recognize has to be fixed. But I still think that, Dr. Reich's basic point still holds true, which is that you're still going to pick up a lot of people who are going to be subject to a tax and that has no bearing on healthcare utilization or bringing down healthcare costs, but again, simply based on where they live and how old they are.
And you don't think there's any way to fix that?
Well, the other sort of item, which is, again, I think has been pointed out as flawed even by proponents, is the cost index. The CPI plus one, the American Benefits Council, which is not, you know, part of the AFL-CIO, of course, has pointed out that that's just, that's the AMT all over again, actually on steroids, because it's just going to accelerate the number of plans that are going to get taxed over a very short period of time. So our position right now is that the House should prevail, and Speaker Pelosi's comments last night, I think, were very strong in that area, and I certainly think that's plan A right now.
Thank you.
This is Larry Michon. Let me just say, the problem with this is it's based on a flawed theory of how to control healthcare costs. It's based on a theory of getting consumers to be better purchasers of healthcare. and of trying to shift more costs directly onto people in the form of higher copays and deductibles. And it's not because people are demanding too much health care that we have a bad health care cost curve in the future. It's because we have a fundamentally flawed system of health care. And so I think it's a wrong way to go at the problem. The only reason it develops higher funding for health care is because it taxes more and more people over time, not because it actually changes the fundamental dynamics in the healthcare system. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Michelle Hirsch with Working American Maine. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking my question. I guess this is directed at either Larry or Josh or both. In your December 11th issue brief on called The House Health Care Bill is Right on the Money, early on you say this issue brief argues that the House surtax raises more money and it does so just as reliably, et cetera. My question is, does the Senate excise tax, as it's currently structured, actually be, is it a reliable funding source?
The reliable, just to provide a little bit of context, I mean, there have been people who have claimed that a virtue of the excise tax is that by attaching the value of the tax to the cost of health care, given that the cost of healthcare in this country rises faster than the cost of most things, you'll have a funding source that rises with the demands of providing healthcare to people. And we pointed out in our issue brief that the incomes of the top 1% are actually one of the few things that have risen just as fast or faster than overall healthcare costs. And so that's why we say that House surtax is just as reliable. On the question of the excise tax, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, there's I think it's reliable in the sense of most of the revenue that is projected to be gained by imposing the excise tax is because companies will try to cut back on generosity of health plans and increase taxable wages, and so you'll see increased tax collections as people get wages instead of health care. Even if companies don't pass on that reduced health care cost in the form of higher wages, I think we'll still get the tax money. I mean, it'll come from business income taxes rather than wages being taxed, but I think we'll get the money that way, so it's reliable. I will note one kind of irony to this. I mean, one reason why we get so much money from the excise tax is because we're assuming that healthcare costs rise very fast in that window of 2014 to 2019. The whole point of the excise tax is to reduce the growth of those healthcare costs. And so essentially projecting lots of revenue coming in from the excise tax is admitting that it will have a trivial impact on the overall trajectory of those healthcare costs. And so personally, yeah, I think it will raise revenue reliably, but only because it will completely fail to change the overall trajectory of healthcare spending in the U.S.
That was Josh Bivens speaking, by the way, for those on the phone. Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Lisa Wagsness with the Boston Globe.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking the question. I guess this is for Representative Courtney. The Republicans have criticized the health care plans in both houses being inadequately funded, partly because they say Congress won't have the political will to go through with cuts like reductions in Medicare growth rates to hospice and nursing homes in the future. To the extent that this tax is really politically objectionable and that there are big bumps, you know, when those high-cost states, the cushion phases out after 3 years and that kind of thing, and as this tax sort of rapidly moves to affect more and more people, I mean, is this creating sort of a hole in the financing of the healthcare plan that we don't see in the CBO
Yes, that's a great question. The political reality of this sort of time-released plan is going to create, I think, tremendous potential for deficits because, as we've seen with the AMT, which, again, operates on the same sort of automatic mechanism basis, Congresses, whether they're Democrat or Republican, didn't have the political will to allow the tax to go into full operation. And I think you know, as you point out, the three-year phase-out that the Senate has for regional variation, you know, when those 17 states, you know, California, New York included, with large delegations, suddenly face the reality of a large inclusion of families getting taxed, that the political pressure will be almost irresistible to extend out the carve out for those states. And I think you already saw a little bit of the pig pile in the Senate in terms of different occupations trying to get relief. The last group that got in the tent, so to speak, was longshoremen when the Senate passed the bill on Christmas Eve. You know, so they, along with mining, public safety, you know, mostly male-dominated occupations, got the adjustment. I think, as was mentioned earlier, female-dominated professions and occupations, teaching, nursing, were left out. And I think you could make a very good argument that their health care costs are as acute as high-risk, so-called high-risk professions, which the Senate tried to carve out there. So, you know, this will not be the final word, even if the Senate is able to, you know, pull a rabbit out of their hat in terms of the conference committee, in terms of the way this tax would play itself out. I just think the politics of it down the road would make its reliability very shaky.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from the line of Mark Gruenberg with Press Associates Union News Service.
Yeah, well, this is the follow-up question for Congressman Courtney. Assuming that the Senate bill or something like it does emerge out of the conference, I hate to call it a conference committee because that's not what it is. It's conference staffers plus Senator Reid and Speaker Pelosi. What are its prospects in the House? It sounds like something that you guys are going to take a hike from.
Well, it's too early to say. Again, we're having our first real conference, caucus rather, tomorrow, and I think you'll see people wading in on it. I would just say that my letter's attraction of 190 co-signatures is a pretty powerful statement that there's pretty broad-based opposition. I mean, it was from all ends of the caucus, progressives, New Dems, Blue Dogs, none of the above signed on to the letter there. So, you know, I think if you're ranking the issues that have to get worked out in whatever you want to call the process right now, I mean, this one is right at the top of the list in terms of how you pay for the bill.
Well, does that mean that if you're ignored, you guys say forget it, then the bill?
I don't see how the bill moves if it's a take it or leave it attitude from the Senate. Again, I don't want to get too ahead of myself in terms of political prognostications because, you know, in fairness, that tomorrow is the first day that the leadership is going to report back on their meetings with the Senate. But based on the phone call that we had right before Christmas with the caucus and some of the feedback at the Chiefs of Staff's meeting, I don't see any weakening of rank-and-file members' concern about this issue. Let's put it that way.
Thank you.
Next, we'll go to the line of Brian Friel with the National Journal.
This question is for the congressman, but maybe for some of the others. And this is a smaller issue in the bill, but it seems to carry some of the same political implications, which is the limits on the flexible spending accounts. And I wonder if you could talk about whether you see any political problems in that in the limits there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's it's a program right now that a lot of middle-class families use, and you know, there are certainly arguments against it in terms of whether or not it's the most efficient way to shelter income for truly healthcare-related costs for families. And I'm pretty sympathetic to them, to be honest with you. But right now, I think the fundamental issue of excise tax versus surtax is still, you know, the hurdle that people have got to figure out a way to clear. And I think the flexible savings account idea is still somewhat on a lower tier of discussion.
I Our next question is a follow-up from Alec McGinnis with The Washington Post.
Just want to go back to Josh's point about where the revenue would come from if we don't see this resulting in higher wages. It's something I've been wondering about myself, and I was a little surprised that Josh was so confident that you would get the revenue no matter what through business taxes, and that there's not a concern that money would just sort of that's given this sort of inadequacy of business taxes in some areas that it would just some of that those gains would just kind of get scrolled away in a way and not get captured in a way that they would if it was passed on in terms in wages.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to say we will get the amount JCT is saying to the penny if we don't see it pass through in the form of higher wages. I mean, that said, I do think at the margin that the business income tax rate is actually looks quite a bit like the marginal rate for wage earners. And I don't see, I do know that the effective business tax rate is less than the statutory one, but I do think at the margin, if all of a sudden you give sort of a windfall to businesses in the form of they're able to offer less generous health plans, but they're able to not pass it on in the way of wages, I think we would claw back a lot of that money in the form of taxes, and we would get revenue that looks, ballpark what the JCT is assuming, even with a full wage pass-through.
Okay, thanks.
Next, we have a question from Kevin Borgardus with The Hill newspaper.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. This is directed to Congressman Courtney. Just wondering if there's a chance to thread the needle perhaps on, it seems some of the more central senators are not fans of the millionaire's tax. You, of course, are, and about 190 other House members are not a fan of the excise tax. Is there any chance maybe increasing the Medicare payroll tax from what it already is in the Senate to kind of find a middle ground here?
Certainly, I think that's an idea that deserves exploration. I know, I'll give Senator Reid credit for in the final cut on the Senate bill using that as a healthcare-related tax to at least move the process further ahead. I know the Citizens for Tax Justice at a roundtable that we had before the Christmas break talked about the fact that the Medicare tax is still not applied towards unearned income, and if you did apply it towards unearned income above $250,000, you could go a long way to filling the gap here between the two chambers. And I frankly think there's a pretty good argument that that's good tax policy. We all remember the John Edwards episode during his campaign where he took legal fees in the form of unearned income as a way of avoiding the Medicare tax, Medicare payroll tax. And frankly, that's the present arrangement does invite that kind of gaming of the system. And I think, again, assuming you set a high enough trigger for when that would kick in for unearned income, that really comports with, I think, both chambers' goals of having a pay-for that's related to the healthcare system, which is certainly what the Senate wants to see, but also to protect the middle class, which is where the House is obviously more focused.
Thank you.
If there are any additional questions, you may press star 1 at this time. And currently, speakers, there's one question in queue. That's a follow-up from Lisa Wagnus at the Boston Globe.
Hi, thanks. I just had one other question. I was wondering if you could, Josh, maybe go into a bit more detail about how the extent to which this would really be focused on small businesses, and also whether you've looked at whether it would offset, in many cases, the tax credits that would be available to them in this bill.
Well, we have a lot of circumstantial evidence on how much this hits small businesses disproportionately. I mean, the number one piece of evidence is just from the Joint Committee of Taxation scoring of the tax. I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but I know it's roughly, more than a quarter of plans are affected by this tax, but only about 14% of tax filing units. This is by 2019. And so right off the bat, you know, those are smaller plans than average. That's who's going to be hit by this tax. I would also point you to some work on our website by my colleague Elise Gould and a co-author. They show, you know, what are the best predictors of who will be hit by a tax on high-cost plans, and size of firm and age of workforce are the number one predictors. Again, I don't have those exact numbers, but I would look for it. I think that the name of the paper is Who is Affected by Taxing the Employer Exclusion for Healthcare, something along those lines. And so those are the, you know, I think those are the two big pieces of evidence. Oh, and then the other piece of evidence someone already talked about before, you know, for equivalent coverage, the smallest firms pay about 18% more in premiums on average than larger firms. And so right there, you can definitely see a lot of small firms will be pushed over the threshold of the tax, not based on offering more comprehensive plans, but just by virtue of being smaller. In regards to whether or not it's going to offset some of the tax credits they get, you know, that's a good question. I definitely couldn't tell you off the top of my head in the aggregate how much of the small business tax credits are going to be sort of sterilized by the excise tax, but, you know, it's a good question. I don't know it off the top of my head.
This is Larry. Let me just add, I think people expect, and this is studied by Mercer and others, that the excise tax won't actually ever hit. What people are going to do is reduce their plan. They're going to take on plans with higher copays and deductibles and reduce the benefits. So it's not like the tax will actually fall on small business. It's going to fall on the small business workers who are going to end up with worse plans and higher out-of-pocket costs.
Thanks.
So if that's...
Hey, Larry, I've got to get off. This is Joe. Courtney.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. I think we can... Operator, we can end the phone call. If people want to follow up with us, they can call Nancy Coleman at 202-331-5546, and they can reach Josh or me through Nancy and Representative Courtney's office. We'll be able to take phone calls for him, and we can try to hook people up with Bob Reich as well if you want some kind of follow-up. So
great.
Thank
you, Larry.
Very much.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you very much for your participation.